Hello, everybody. This is George Ann Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And I guess you can hear my wobbly voice. Oh, my goodness, I'm getting laryngitis. Anyway, we're really blessed to have David Seeloff with us. And I'm going to skip the long intro, but this is the People That History Forgot, Part 13. David?
Hi, Georgianne.
Hi.
Yeah, I'll take it from here.
Okay.
Yeah, The People That History Forgot by Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And the title of this chapter, Chapter 13, is From Babylon to Syria. And this will be a very interesting chapter. Now, these are the words of Dr. Ernest Martin that he has written in his book. That the people of the later Roman Empire were basically from Syria, Phoenicia, Samaria, and Asia Minor is without doubt. These Easterners replaced the old stock of Rome and Italy. As plain as this is, however, it is one thing to say that these new Romans were transplanted Syrian types, but it is quite another to show that they were also politically and religiously Babylonians in large measure. And we will now look further into this issue. Let us first concentrate on the Samaritans. The Bible tells us that the Samaritans were originally made up of five Babylonian tribes that came into the area of Ephraim and Manasseh in the 7th century B.C. And this is fine and true, but what is not generally realized is the fact that the scriptures also reveal that Babylonians were not the only ones to settle in the Samaria area. There were also other neighbor tribes to the Babylonians, peoples from Mesopotamia and Persia, who also came into the region of Samaria and other areas west of the Euphrates. Indeed, the Bible and early Assyrian records show that the Assyrians actually settled people from Mesopotamia and Persia, which was known in ancient times as Elam, E-L-A-M, in all areas of Syria and Phoenicia, as well as in the region of Samaria. Some scholars have restricted the Samaritan colonization of the Mediterranean seacoast Some scholars have restricted the Samaritan colonization of the Mediterranean seacoast regions only to the region which became known as Samaria. But from the records of the Samaritans themselves, and those of the Jews, and those of the Assyrians, and especially the records of the Bible, we can know that the Babylonians were not only limited to Samaria. They were settled all over the area from the Euphrates River to Tyre, to Sidon, and into Samaria when the former inhabitants of those lands were uprooted, not just the Israelites, but the former inhabitants were uprooted and taken to regions in Assyria and Persia. So let us first look at the biblical record. When the Jews were rebuilding the temple after the Babylonian captivity, the peoples of Samaria came to the Jews and said in Ezra 4 and verse 2, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, which brought us up hither." So the Jews declined this Samaritan petition because the Samaritans were mixing pagan religious practices with their worship of Yahweh. And this rejection infuriated the Samaritans. They resolved to thwart any attempts to rebuild the temple if they could not have a part in its construction. And thereupon, they wrote a letter to the king of Persia asking him to put a stop to the construction. The contents of this letter are interesting because it reveal a lot more about the origin of the Samaritans and their brother tribes and about where they came to reside in the area of Palestine and Syria. The record of this letter in the Bible affords the historian a major key regarding the distribution of Babylonians west of the Euphrates. So let's notice what the Samaritans and their allies said of themselves. This is in Ezra chapter 4, verses 9 to 10. Quote, "Then wrote Rehum, the chancellor, and Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their companions, the Dinaites, and the Arphathakites, the Tarpalites, the Arpharsites, the Archivites, the Babylonians, the Shushanites, the Dehavites, and the Elamites, and the rest of the nations, whom the great and noble Ashnepar," or as we know today, Ashurbanipal, "brought over and set in the cities of Samaria, and the rest," meaning the rest of the cities, "that are on this side of the river," in other words, in the cities west of the Euphrates, "at such a time," end quote. So let's notice that all the tribes mentioned in this letter, 10 groups of people altogether, were from eastern areas. Almost all were from Mesopotamia and Persia. And more importantly, note that these nations were settled not only in the cities of Samaria, but also in the rest of the cities on the west side of the Euphrates River. As far as the Persian government was concerned, which flourished at the time this letter was written, this entire region was called Syria. Note what Professor Bevan stated about the phrase, quote, "on this side of the river," end quote. This is from Bevan's book, House of Seleucus, Volume 1, page 234. This was the ordinary designation of Syria in the official language of the old Persian Empire. So these eastern peoples were brought by the Assyrians in the 7th century BC into the whole of the region we now call Syria, not into Samaria alone. And they were brought into this region area, into this northern area, to fill up the devastation and the void which hung on the land after the Assyrian wars. Let us remember that northern Israel was emptied of Israelites. It was the Samaritan people who came in to replace them. On the other hand, we are told that ancient Syria to the north of Israel was also invaded by the Assyrians, and that many of the ancient Aramaeans, the early Syrians, were taken back to northern Syria. The land of Syria, west of the Euphrates River and southward toward Palestine, had very few people left within it, and very much like the land of Israel to its south. Now the prophet Amos, in chapter 1, verses 3 to 5, foretold that the Aramaeans, those of Syria and northern Mesopotamia, were to be taken captive by the Assyrians to the land of Kir, the Kir Valley area just south of the Caucasus Mountains. This prophecy probably does not mean that every single Aramaean was taken away, although on the surface that is what the prophecy says. Note, without doubt, a good deal of the native stock of ancient Aram was certainly removed from their land. Those few who were left must have amalgamated with the incoming stock from the east. The land of Syria was then repopulated, just like the land of Israel. These new peoples who came into the land of Syria along with those who went on to Samaria in the hill country of Ephraim, were people who were once allied with Assyria. They were brought into the area as the friends of the Assyrians in order to provide a buffer zone of protection to Assyria and Mesopotamia, who had their centers of empire in the east. After all, the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean was one of the most strategic areas to the Assyrian Empire. In other words, they moved colonists to this area, peoples who were friendly. The Assyrians did not move rebellious nations into the Syrian and Palestinian areas. That would have been the height of folly. Besides, Syria and Samaria were never regions of exile, as were the Caucasus and the Caspian Sea regions. The fact is, these people, which the Bible shows, came into Syria and Samaria from the regions of Mesopotamia and Persia, came to the area as colonists of Assyria. Many of them came from regions annexed to Syria by Esarhaddon, a former Assyrian king, but they were his allies. They came to redevelop the land and to strengthen it for Assyria. And actually, they probably received some type of remuneration and payment for moving to this area. But it would have been the height of absurdity for the Assyrians to have planted rebellious tribes into an area bordering the naturally rebellious Egypt. The evidence strongly suggests that these transplanted people were being granted these lands by Assyria in order to stabilize the western flank of the empire and to make it secure. Later, the Babylonian Empire came along. These very people proved to be even more helpful. During the time of the Persian Empire, these Babylonians and Persians were still in the Syrian and Samaritan regions. They were, as the Bible says in Ezra chapter 4, verses 9 to 10, in all the areas west of the Euphrates. Even the records of the Samaritans and the Jews support the above information. Josephus mentions an official letter of the Samaritans, which was written to Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century BC, in which the Samaritans stated that their forefathers had at one time come from the northern area near the city of Sidon. This is in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 12, Section 5, Paragraph 5. The Samaritans called themselves the Sidonians, who lived in Samaria. These Samaritans had maintained their close ethnic ties to the people of Sidon, which really meant people who were under the control of the Mediterranean Phoenician cities in most of the coastal regions of the Levant. In fact, the Samaritans from Babylon and other areas in Mesopotamia and Persia had kinfolk all along the northern area of the Phoenician coast. And the city of Sidon became a major center of this Babylonian influence. In Assyrian times, this ancient city of Sidon had been completely destroyed by Esarhaddon, king of Assyria. The Sidonian king was killed, and all the former people taken captive. Esarhaddon tells us how the destruction came about in his own official cuneiform records. He stated that after Sidon's destruction, he then rebuilt the city and, naming it after himself, restocked it with people from the countries of the east. About Sidon and the Sidonians, Esarhaddon said in Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern Texts, page 290, column B, quote, "I drove to Assyria his teeming people, which could not be counted. I settled therein people from the mountain regions, the area of Elam, and the city shore of the east, meaning Babylon, those who belonged to me as my share of the booty. I set over them in the eastern lands officers of mine as governors, end quote. In another text, he wrote of the early Sidonians and said, quote, I led to Assyria his teeming subjects, which could not be counted. And this is in Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern Texts, page 291a. As for Tyre, the sister city of Sidon, Esarhaddon said, quote, I took away from him, meaning the king of Tyre, those of his towns which are situated on the mainland, and reorganized the region, turning it over to Assyria. This is Pritchard's Ancient Near Eastern Text, 291a, also. And thus, the Phoenician cities of Tyre and Sidon, which existed before Esarhaddon, had their populations stripped bare, and this is what previous Assyrian kings had done with the people of Israel, who once lived in the hill country of Ephraim and other areas of Israel. And then, as his own records show, as well as the biblical account, he placed in their areas new peoples who had come from the mountain countries of Persia and the Mesopotamian regions around Babylon. This means that the whole of the Mediterranean coast around these former cities of the Phoenicians were settled by kinfolk of the same people that were brought to Samaria. And this is why, in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Samaritans called themselves as people who had come from Sidon. The fact is, however, all the peoples on the west side of the Euphrates in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah had been brought to these regions, the regions of Syria, the Levant, and Samaria, in the time of Esarhaddon. They were basically of Babylonian and Elamite racial stocks.
David, when you say brought to those areas, were they forced, or were they, how did that happen?
Well, no, these people were brought there as colonists.
Oh, okay.
So they were, as Dr. Martin said, and I had mentioned also, they were actually probably paid to do that.
Oh.
You know, you get the troublemakers out of the way, and then you move in people that you are more likely to be able to trust. And that way you attempted to build stability later on, and like he said, a buffer zone.
Yeah.
So indeed, when Antiochus answered the letter of the Samaritans about them having first lived in Sidon, and after having checked those public records, he addressed them as the Sidonians who live at Shechem. This is in Josephus Antiquities, Book 12, Section 5, Paragraph 5. And even Josephus himself refers to them as Sidonians of recent origin. But at the same time, he said they were ancient, they anciently came from eastern countries. And besides this, an early Jewish commentary on the scriptures called the Palestinian Targum, written about 50 BC, referring to Genesis 10, calls Sidon a Samaritan city. The Targum calls it Cutha, that is Cuthanis, the city of the Cuthites. Now, Cuthites was and still is one of the names that the Jews used for the Samaritans. Cutha was one of the cities in Mesopotamia from where they came. Now, what does this all prove? Well, it serves to indicate that the Samaritan influence was not only limited to the hill country of Ephraim. The Samaritans also had kinfolk and other brother tribes in all the region of Sidon and Tyre and all of Assyria that's on this side of the river Euphrates. At least that is precisely what the Bible says and what I believe, according to Ezra chapter 4, verses 9 and 10. Of course, the Babylonians and the Persians were only called Samaritans when they lived in Samaria. But in the other areas, though they were essentially the same people from the east, they went by other names. These Babylonians who lived in Sidon, this was before the Babylonian Empire arose and out of the ashes of Syria. These Babylonians who lived in Sidon were called Sidonians. Though they were, of course, the same basic stock as the Samaritans. Likewise, the transplanted Babylonians in the other cities west of the Euphrates were not called Samaritans, but were also of the same stock. So it is possible to keep things clear, even though it's quite complex. There was, however, as time went on, from the period they were brought into the lands by Esarhaddon, and into the New Testament period, a major difference between the Babylonians of Samaria and the Babylonians and Persians in Sidon and Syria, not in race, but in religion. The Samaritans who lived next to the Jews in Samaria accepted the Old Testament law as a basis for their idolatrous religion, while the others at first cared little for accepting anything of the Old Testament. This singled out the Samaritans as being somewhat different from the others in Syria, but they were all of the same general race. And indeed, we are told by Josephus, as I've already mentioned, that by the first century, the majority of the women in Damascus, a prime city of these transported peoples, the majority of the women in Damascus were practicing Judaism rather than the Samaritanism of their brethren in Samaria. Josephus also stated that the city of Antioch, the capital of Syria, this side of the river Euphrates, had flocks of its citizens who had become proselytes of Judaism, or God-fearers, one rank below proselytes. So, what is the outcome of all this? It means that the Bible puts Babylonians, along with some neighboring tribes of Persians, Elamites, in all the cities of Syria and Phoenicia, as well as in Samaria, and that the secular records support this information. Thus, the Babylonian influence from Antioch to Damascus and to Sidon, and then throughout all of Samaria, was much greater in scope than many scholars may imagine. But there is even more historical information about even the political government, the society, and the religion in some central parts of Mesopotamia, moving from old Babylon on the river Euphrates up to where Baghdad is at the present time, and then westward to Antioch. And this is a fascinating and important part of the history that must be understood by all people who want to know how Babylonianism came to be in all areas of the West, including the Roman Empire. Recall that the prophet Daniel interpreted the vision of Nebuchadnezzar that Babylon was the head of gold of an image, showing all the Gentile governments in a successive way, until the kingdom of God would appear on earth. And in the next section of this book, we will give historical information that will show how Babylon, even in a political and religious sense, moved west, first to Antioch, and then to the city of Rome. So thank you, George Ann. And, you know, we'll move on to chapter 14.
Oh, you can go ahead and do 14 if
okay.
you want to.
Chapter 14 is titled, Syria Becomes the New Babylon. And once again, these are Dr. Martin's words. We now come to a matter concerning ancient history that all historians are able to accept without controversy, and that is this. The Seleucid kingdom, which succeeded the rule of Alexander the Great in Syria, Asia Minor, and other eastern areas, can be designated a Babylonian kingdom. It has been customary to call the Seleucid realm a Greco-Macedonian regime. And this is true, but only on the surface. After Alexander the Great conquered Asia, he made as capital of this vast eastern domain the city of Babylon. He actually planned further African and even European conquests, but was prevented from carrying out his designs by his untimely death at Babylon when he was only 33 years of age. His death put the government into confusion. There was, however, a treaty between the major claimants to the domain, and it was finally divided into four major areas with rulers over each of them. And after some further bickering between the new rulers, the central area of the former empire fell out to Seleucus, a general of Alexander's army. He took over this central Babylonian region and proclaimed himself the king of Babylon. In a short time, he took over all of Syria. And for over 250 years, he and his descendants controlled the areas of Syria and Mesopotamia. As it says in Lempriere's A Classical Dictionary, 3rd edition, page 587, quote, Seleucus, surnamed Nicator, who had received this province of Syria, in his lot in the division of the Macedonian dominions, raised it into an empire. An empire means a kingdom of kingdoms, actually. That's what an empire is. He raised it into an empire known in history by the name of the Kingdom of Syria, or Babylon. So it was known. Seleucus' kingdom was called either a Syrian or a Babylonian kingdom. The two terms became synonymous with Seleucus' rule beginning in 312 BC. And what is interesting, in later times, the kings of the Seleucid Empire consistently called themselves not the kings of Syria, but rather the kings of Babylon. And this is in Bevan's book, The House of Seleucus, Volume 1, page 255. And they wanted to maintain the historical tradition of the old Babylonian Empire, that they were its successors, not that they were simply Syrians or even Greeks, although the top level of society had a Greek gloss. And as we will presently see, the Seleucid kings represented their realm as a resurrection of the old Babylonian kingdom. Now, what type of kingdom was this realm of Seleucus in a racial sense? First of all, it was made up of about 5% Greeks and Macedonians. And many of the soldiers, veterans of Alexander and a few Greek colonists, were, while the rest was made up of the native populations of the various countries of the kingdom. Seleucus was very prone to build new cities in his Asian empire. He built no less than 30 cities. They were all designed on the Greek manner. The architecture was Greek, and so were the social customs. Some few Greek colonists were brought in to give the cities the Greek flavor. And more importantly, Greek was the language imposed on the citizens of this kingdom. And certainly it was the official language, along with Syriac, the commercial language of that empire. From this, we might imagine that the kingdom was, in fact, a real Greek kingdom. But nothing could be further from the truth. The actual Greek racial elements, which Alexander the Great introduced soon, became a thin veneer upon the old traditions, religions, and society in general. What the old stock did, who had been transported there in the days of Esarhaddon, was to adopt practically everything Greek into all their elements that made up their society. But in no way did they give up the fundamental attitudes of their own Babylonian society, which they had been reared in for centuries. While the Greek religions were brought to Syria and Babylon, they soon became Babylonian. And while some Greek peoples came to the area, they soon amalgamated with the native races who were the Syrians and Babylonians. The Seleucid kingdom was only Greek in name only. It was actually a Babylonian kingdom that now had Greek names being used for its traditions, religions, and society in general. It was Babylon in Greek guise. Dr. W.W. Tarn, one of the authors of the Cambridge Ancient History, shows how this Greek kingdom of Seleucus, reverted quickly back into being a Babylonian and Syrian one. This is in Tarn's book, Hellenistic Civilization, page 139. Quote, "Mercenaries settled in Asia," meaning the Seleucid Empire, "had from the start taken native wives. Certainly by the first century, intermarriage and the mixture of peoples in daily life and trade was doing its work. And precisely as in Egypt at the time, the term Greek sometimes denoted culture, but not blood. And the Greek woman, a Syrophoenician by race, talked of in Mark 7, verse 26, was such a culture Greek, perhaps with Greek political rights in her home city. After the European immigration of the few Greek colonists in the 3rd century BC, after that came to an end, first a balance was established, and then the Greek began to lose ground, partly through mixing his blood with Asiatic stocks," unquote. So the disintegration of this Greek veneer was started very early, even with Alexander. He commanded the bulk of his army officers to marry into the native population. And this was done on a wide scale. And contrary to most Greeks, by the way, Macedonians did practice polygamy. So that part of it wasn't a shock to their officers. But on the other hand, as Dr. Martin says, this was done on a wide scale, and even Seleucus, the beginner of the new empire, centered at Babylon, he was married to an eastern princess. The fruit of that mixed union was Antiochus I, the king who followed Seleucus to the throne. And from that time onward, the deterioration continued to such an extent that Greek blood almost wholly disappeared, except in a few isolated districts in the extreme western part of that empire. Certain forms of Greek culture retained their force, and especially the Greek language became the official language of the empire. But the Greek race in the areas that Alexander conquered almost entirely disappeared within a few generations. The Roman historian Livy reports a statement of a Roman consul to his troops in 189 BC, speaking about the submergence of the Greek racial characteristics in the East. Livy said in Book 38, Section 17, quote, "The Macedonians who settled in Alexandria in Egypt, or in Seleucia, or in Babylonia, or in any of their other colonies scattered out throughout the world, have degenerated into Syrians, Parthians, or Egyptians. Whatever is planted in a foreign land by a gradual change in its nature degenerates into that by which it is nurtured," end quote. That was Livy. And though the armies of Antiochus III were sometimes called Greeks, Livy and Plutarch report that they were actually, quote, "all Syrians," end quote. This is in Livy, Book 35, Section 49, Paragraph 8, and in Plutarch, Titus, Number 7, Section 17. So let us also recall what Juvenal said: the multitudes of Greeks in Italy were not Greeks at all, but were from Syria. Quote, the river Orontes has long flowed into the Tiber," meaning the Tiber River, end quote. This is Juvenal, Book 3, Section 62. So all this clearly shows that even though the Syrians had Greek names and even some Greek cultural tendencies, they were hardly real Greeks in a racial sense. In other words, the Greek race in Syria, Palestine, Egypt, and Babylonia succumbed. This decay was begun by Alexander himself when he encouraged and actually ordered his men to marry with Eastern racial stocks. The effect over the generations was the complete overwhelming of the Greek minority. And by the end of the 2nd century BC, the Greek racial element was so small as to be non-existent in most regions in the Seleucid kingdom. The Seleucid kingdom in Asia Minor, Syria, and Mesopotamia had virtually reverted to their native racial stock. As an example of how this reverting can take place, historians give us a modern equivalent of the Greek invasion and penetration of Syria and Babylon. We have the British takeover of India. And just like the spread of the Greek language in nearer Asia, so English became the official tongue of all India. And as Alexander gave Asia a Greek culture, the British gave India its civil service, its jurisprudence, and a form of democracy. However, there is one matter in which the analogy breaks down. Alexander had his men marry into the Asian stock, thus mixing the races, while the British commanded no such thing. And in fact, just the opposite is true. Such intermarriage with the Indians was actively frowned upon, and the Indians themselves did not want to mix with the British. But Alexander actively encouraged the intermarriage of his Greek invaders with the native stocks, wherever they went. The intermarriage of Alexander's Greeks with the natives soon extinguished the Greek blood, while in India there still remains a few small colonies of British race. Thus, it can be plainly observed from the above analogy and from the historical sources that the Greek kingdom of Alexander retreated back to its native population in race and in the psychological attitudes. The records of history prove this conclusively. For example, when Alexander brought his Greek gods and religions to Syria and Babylonia, the natives were willing to call their own gods by some of the Greek names of deity. But to replace the Babylonian gods with the Greek ones, they most emphatically refused. In actual fact, the Greek gods turned into Babylonian ones. Now let's read a quote from Tarn, Hellenistic Civilization, pages 301 to 302. quote, Greece was ready to adopt the gods of the foreigner, but the foreigner rarely reciprocated. Greek Doura, the Greek temple in Mesopotamia, freely admitted the gods of Babylon, but no Greek god entered Babylonian Uruk. Foreign gods might take Greek names, but they took little else. They, the Babylonian gods, were the stronger, and the conquest of Asia, meaning by the Greeks, was bound to fail as soon as the East had gauged its own strength and the Greek weakness. End quote. Speaking of this retention of native worship in the East, the great Belgian archaeologist and historian of the first part of this century, Dr. Frans Coumont, remarks in Coumont's Oriental Religions in Roman Paganism, page 22, quote, the native religions retained all their prestige and independence. In their ancient sanctuaries, that took rank with the richest and most famous in the world, a powerful clergy continued to practice ancestral devotions according to the barbarian rites, and frequently liturgy, everywhere performed with scrupulous respect, remained Semitic in Syria. End quote. The old Babylonian gods of the Syrians were not exchanged for the incoming Greek ones. Besides, it can be clearly shown well over 95% of the people of Syria and Asia, even at the beginning of the Seleucid Empire, were native Easterners. The invading Greeks had little chance of uprooting the basic religions and philosophies of these peoples. And by an intermarriage, it was the Greek alien who gave way to the native Easterner. The later Greek kings succumbed almost entirely to Eastern ways, especially in religion. As Dr. Tarn says in Hellenistic Civilization, page 306, the East led its conqueror captive. The political aspects of the Seleucid kingdom were no less Babylonian. They based their administration on the old Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian forms. Thus, there was a historical continuity in government all the way from Assyria to the Seleucid kingdom. That's Tarn, Hellenistic Civilization, page 118 to 119. I'm going to read an extended quote here. One feature of Seleucid rule was the resurrection of Babylonia, whose ancient culture was to the Seleucids what that of Egypt was to the Ptolemies. Cuneiform literature revived. Under Persian rule, the art had decayed. And besides, scientific astronomical work and business documents, chronicles of current events were written, and myths were versified. Rituals, incantations, and omen literature were frequently copied and studied, as were Sumerian hymns and their Babylonian translations. The last cuneiform document extant dates from 7 BC, and Dr. Martin adds, the latest finds we have now brought the last cuneiform text to about 100 AD. So, going on with Tarn, this activity points to a religious revival which was fostered by the early kings. Antiochus I carried to completion Alexander's project of restoring Bel's temple at Babylon, which Xerxes had destroyed. He refounded Nebo's temple at Borisippa, while Bel's priest Borosiris dedicated to Antiochus, his work on Babylonian history. Under Seleucus, a priest from Uruk, possibly at his request, found at Susa and copied the old ritual of the gods at Uruk, whose worship was reestablished. The temple of Anu at Uruk was restored in 182 BC under Seleucus IV. The priests of Uruk also collected a temple library. Mr. Sidney Smith has suggested to me, to Dr. Tarn, that is, that the Seleucids favored Babylonian religion as a bulwark against Zoroastrianism. That's another Persian religion. So this is unquote, Dr. Tarn. So the Seleucids almost totally abandoned the religious forms of the Olympian gods and reverted to Babylonianism. The Seleucid Empire witnessed, as Dr. Tarn has clearly observed, the resurrection of Babylonia. Even Alexander's policy to bring back the old Babylonian Empire. Alexander presented himself to the Babylonians as the restorer of the old order rather than as an innovator. So says Bevan, House of Seleucus, Volume 1, page 245. Continuing with Dr. Martin's words. And even though the Greek language became the lingua franca of the kingdom, and though the Babylonian gods took Greek names, the religious and political society remained Babylonian. Alexander believed that the Greek gods were the same as the Babylonian gods, though there were some national differences that existed, which to him were of little consequence. All the gods and goddesses of the world were, to Alexander, basically the same deities that had various national names and ethnic peculiarities associated with them. As an example of this, perhaps we can mention the idol which Antiochus Epiphanes erected in the temple at Jerusalem. Native records tell us that it was Baal Shamayim, the Babylonian sun god. Shemesh means the sun in Hebrew and Aramaic. The Greek name of the idol was Zeus Olympus, or the Romans called him Jupiter Capitolinus, but it was clearly the old Mesopotamian sun god. The Seleucids adopted the Babylonian religion throughout their domain. All over Syria, the Seleucids restored temple lands to the priests, and these were vast estates in some cases. This was to get the priesthood on their side to help them and assist them in governing the people. The cooperation between the priests and the kings was generally very good, except when priestly power got so strong that they, in the time of the later Seleucids, began to dictate to the kings certain policies to be followed. In short, as Dr. Tarn remarks, the Seleucid kingdom brought about the resurrection of Babylonia. No wonder the Seleucids consistently identified themselves with the ancient Babylonians and that their kingdom, as Lempereur's classical dictionary records, was known as the Kingdom of Babylon in Lempereur's page 587. Let's look at the Babylonians and the Syrians. Seleucus had his first capital at Babylon. In commemoration of his desire to make a revived Babylonian kingdom, he devised a new standard calendar for his realm. The first year of this calendar was 312 BC, when he first made Babylon the capital of his empire. Throughout his realm, people were required to date all documents from this new era. The new system, based upon the old Babylonian lunar solar calendar, was called the Seleucid calendar, and the first year of it was known as the beginning of the Seleucid era. All the Jews of Babylon took over this era for computation of dates subsequent to 312 BC. This era was even followed later on by Palestinian Jews. It was only abandoned by official Jews when the era of creation was finally adopted in the second century after Christ. This was during the just before the writing down of the Talmuds. So this new calendar of Seleucus was important for it. It focused attention upon Seleucus as the new Babylonian king. And by virtue of this, he was reckoned as the ruler of the central region of Alexander's empire. A few years after making the city of Babylon his headquarters, Seleucus decided to build a new capital city 40 miles north on the Tigris. The reason for the move was mainly brought about by nature. Old Babylon was decaying, and the Euphrates was changing its course from the city, away from the city. Uncontrollably, swamps were beginning to abound in the area, and also the ravages of war had taken their toll on the old city. So Seleucus built a new city using some of the material from the old city of Babylon. Significantly, the king demanded that the population of old Babylon move to this new city on the Tigris. It was called Seleucia on the Tigris, or New Babylon. Thus, the Babylon of Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar was practically left empty of inhabitants. The old city went into a state of decay very soon. And in the time of Jesus, it was in ruins and virtually empty. This is because Seleucus built his new city north of Babylon and ordered the population to move there. These facts have long been known to historians, but the general public today, and many ministers of religion, are not aware of this change from the original Babylon to another one that is where Baghdad is now located. This new city was called New Babylon and Seleucus after the king. So let's read what Prideaux, in his book Old and New Testament Connected, volume 1, page 540, read what this has to say. Quote, Seleucus, having called this city by his own name and designed it for an eminent monument thereof in after ages, gave it many privileges above other cities of the East, and these were a further invitation to the Babylonians to transport themselves in it. And by these means, Babylon, meaning the old Babylon of the Euphrates, became wholly desolated, so that nothing was left remaining of it but its walls. End quote. Prideaux. The new city of Seleucus was Greek on the outside, but in the core it was Babylonian. The ground plan, for instance, was built as an eagle, the symbol of the old Babylonian empire. As Bevan says in the House of Seleucus, page 250, quote, although the days were long past when the Babylonians had borne rule in Asia, the Babylonian people and the Babylonian civilization existed still. End quote. The new city gathered to it not only the inhabitants of old Babylon, but also people from Assyria, Mesopotamia, Babylonia, and Syria. That is, from all Mesopotamia. And this is according to Smith's Smaller Classical Dictionary, page 476. This city became New Babylon, the capital of the Seleucid Empire. As Bivens says, Babylon was simply, quote, transferred to another site, end quote. This is in his book, House of Seleucus, page 253. It became common to call the inhabitants of Seleucia on the Tigris, the, quote, Babylonians, end quote. That's according to Strabo in his Geography, Book 6, Section 7, Paragraph 43. So this means that the civilization of Babylon did not cease to exist. And while it is true that the old site of the former Babylon, which had existed for almost 2,000 years, went into ruin, the political and religious Babylon continued to flourish with the new city on the Tigris River. This, however, does not end the story. There was yet to be one more move in Western Asia of the political and religious Babylon, and we will continue with that story in the next chapter. So thank you, Georgianne.
Thank you, David. And I won't go into anything because my voice is about to go away. So God bless everybody out there that's listening. Good night.